So if you would take your Bibles and turn to the book of Joshua, we'll be spending most of our time here. We're not going to go through this book in detail. Rather, we're just going to talk about it in general. Joshua begins a section of the Old Testament that's generally called the prophets. You'll find references like, for instance, Jesus talks about the law and the prophets. Usually when it refers to the law, it's referring to the first five books, that the ones that Moses wrote. And the bulk of that, even though, yes, Genesis is a historical account, the bulk of the five books that Moses wrote were about the laws that God wanted the people to follow. After that was a section that was basically known as the prophets. It's everybody else who came after Moses, who brought God's word. And each of those books were called the prophet because one or sometimes more than one prophet, other than Moses, was involved in the writing of the book. In our Bibles, they've been slightly rearranged from the Hebrew Bibles. This section begins what's known as the books of history. Because while they are written by prophets, they mostly deal with the historical account of what happened to Israel. When we left off with Deuteronomy, Moses had just died. Joshua was named as the following leader. And he is charged with conquesting the land of Canaan, leading the people into the land of Canaan and settling it. It is believed that Joshua is the author's book, though there's no absolutely positive statement that you can point to and say this was Joshua's writing, this book, other than, except for the last few lines, there's three verses at the end of the book that couldn't have been written by Joshua because it describes Joshua's death and burial. So obviously somebody else had to add that one in. But most people, like the five books of Moses, the very last chapter talks about the death of Moses. Most people think that was probably Joshua who wrote that book. Somebody who followed Joshua probably ended up finishing off the book of Joshua. For an outline of the book, though, let's talk about how the book is laid out. It basically starts out for the first five chapters describing their entrance into the land of Canaan. In what we've seen in our Bible reading, in Joshua chapter 1, is an encouragement by God to be able to go ahead and succeed both in taking over the daunting task of following Moses. Can you imagine being the person who was picked to follow Moses as far as leading? Sometimes we have gospel preachers come here and they do such a wonderful job presenting lessons, and then you think, okay, now I got to get up the next day on Sunday and start delivering lessons, and you don't feel quite adequate to the job. And I can understand with Moses that Joshua probably doesn't feel quite up to the task. And so there is advice at the beginning of Joshua in Joshua chapter 1. I'd like to read just a bit of this again. Joshua chapter 1, and I get my Bible over there. And starting with verse 5, God says, "No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I've been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give to them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." It's an interesting statement because if you look at the beginning of the book of Jeremiah, God basically tells Jeremiah very much the same thing. You need to face down these people. You will, basically he tells them, you're going to have a rock for a face. You will tell these people you will not show any fear. You will not show any sign of backing down. He tells Ezekiel the same thing. You will face these people. And Joshua is told, you will be strong and you will be courageous. Now, sometimes when we read this book, I don't know, have you ever thought about how old Joshua is? See, they've already wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Joshua was one of the 12 spies that were sent out, so he couldn't have been a child at the beginning of the 40 years. He had to be an adult. He has to be at least probably 60 years old. Josephus says he was 85 when this was said to him. Most of us are thinking about settling down, you know, 60, 85. Joshua just started his career in leading God's people. And at the end of the book, he dies at the age of 110. So God tells Joshua he needs to be strong and courageous. And as they're about to enter the land of Canaan, they're on the east side of the Jordan River, on the far side. Two spies are sent. And in Joshua chapter, because I can't spell today, in chapter 2, we have the account of the two spies who are sent in to spy out the land. And they particularly go to Jericho, which is one of the major cities, in the center part of the land. A little bit to the south, but it's basically the center part of the land. To spy it out and to decide what to do or how they should approach things. One interesting tidbit in here is that they run across a woman named Rahab. We are told, in fact, what's interesting is also she's always referred to as Rahab the harlot. And they run into her, and she manages to hide these spies, and she makes a statement of faith that is actually amazing when you think about it. She is a Canaanite. Her living is not something is scriptural. It's not something is righteous. And yet she makes a statement saying, we heard about what happened with your God, and we know he's going to conquer this land. And she asked for salvation for her household and her extended family. Here's a person who, they haven't started basically yet. Yeah, they had some conquests on the other side of the river, but they really hadn't started yet. And here's a woman expressing full faith and confidence that God's going to triumph. Probably more faith than the Israelites had. And what's interesting is, in the lineage of Christ, hold your finger here and go over to Matthew chapter 1. And if you look down at verse 5, there are not too many women mentioned in Christ's lineage. But Rahab's one. It says in verse 5, to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab, and to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth, and to Obed Jesse. Boaz is the man that we read about in the book of Ruth. Rahab is his mother. And so we find some interesting little bits of tidbits there, and it becomes then she's part of the lineage of Christ. Rahab is also listed in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 31. Flipping over there as a hero of faith. And again, if you look through the list of people that are notable heroes of faith, there's not a whole lot of women mentioned there. But in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 31, it says, by faith Rahab the harlot did not perish among those who were disobedient, after she had welcomed the spies in peace. And so she becomes a very notable character. And we ought to learn some lessons from the faith that she demonstrated. In Joshua chapter 3 is the actual crossing of the Jordan. It is springtime when they decided to cross. That is the time when all the snow melts way up in the Lebanon Mountains. The Jordan River is at flood stage. Yet this is the time that they decide to cross the Jordan. And the, as soon as the priests walk in with the ark, as soon as their feet started to touch the water stopped and piled up above them. And the Israelites were able to cross the Jordan on dry ground. Another interesting tidbit here is that this is probably the area where Jesus was baptized. Because when it talked about John baptizing, he was down in near Bethany beyond the Jordan. This is about the same area where they had crossed at. As they were crossing, they decided in chapter 4 that they were going to make a memorial. Actually, two memorials were going to be done. One was to take rocks from the side of which they had crossed, and they built up a memorial in the middle of the riverbed, standing up rocks, one for each tribe. And then they took rocks from the riverbed, and they carried them out with them, and they carried it to their first camping spot. Those two memorials was to, for the later generations to remember that they had crossed the Jordan by the power of God. Because it would be a testament that there was a pile of rocks under the river that everybody can see. How did they get there? Because God had stopped the water. And those river stones that got up here came from the middle of the bed. And how did they get here? Because God stopped the water. And they were able to carry them out. One of them was, like I said, in the river. Take a look at Joshua chapter 4, verse 9. So Joshua set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan at the place where the feet of the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant were standing, and they were there to this day. And in, then in chapter 4 and verse 20, those stones that came out of the Jordan, it says, these 12 stones which they had taken up from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal, which was their first camping spot. Getting there, they then in chapter 5 celebrate the Passover. It is the first Passover in the land of Canaan that they were told that they would get for an inheritance. Second one since they had started after the 40-year wandering. But this is the first one as they're entering the land of Canaan that they get to celebrate in their land. So it becomes a very important thing. But it also gives us a date at which things happen. If you look at Joshua 4 verse 19, it says, now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and camped at Gilgal on the eastern side of Jericho. And in chapter 5 verse 10, it says, while the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. And so they were able to celebrate the Passover to remember God's deliverance of their people. Also interesting is mentioned here is that this at this time, the next day, the manna stopped. They've been fed by God for 40 years. And now that they have arrived in the land of Canaan, were able to eat of its produce, the manna stopped. In verse 12 it says, and the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land. So the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. Starting with then chapter 6 is then the conquest. And it starts out by the central region was conquered first. And that starts with chapter 6 and goes up to chapter 9. It's talking about the conquest of the central region. This is the one where you get the idea of divide and conquer. He goes right into the middle of Canaan and takes out the middle part of the country. This then divides it into two different regions and makes it easier to then conquer. Chapter 6 is the fall of Jericho itself. Jericho was probably one of the larger cities in that region, the major city. It was right near the crossing point. It was probably one of the centers of commerce. And chapter 6 is a very good place to go looking for lessons dealing with faith and of how works have to work with faith, because we all know from little childhood about the Israelites marching around Jericho once every day for 6 days, and seven times on the seventh day, and the walls fell down. If you think about how much faith would it take to go marching around a city, being told that you're going to conquer the city, and it's got this huge fortification, and all you're doing is marching. Just marching around in silence until the last day. Just marching around once every day. That's faith. But it's also a good illustration of the grace of God. Because the Israelites, when they get done marching around and they shout and they blow the trumpets, I guarantee you the shouting and the blowing of the trumpets did not make those walls fall down. It was by God's grace that they were able to conquer. And yet we see that God expects man to do something and believe him. So faith and works working together so that God will then give his grace to give what he promised. Because so many people have the hard time understanding that today. And this makes a perfect illustration of that. People want to say, well, we're faith, saved by grace alone, or we're saved by faith alone more often. But no, the Bible never teaches that. It's always faith working with works. It's always faith in the grace of God, and nothing that we do earns it, but God still expects us to do what he told us to do. In the next chapter, chapter 7, there's a little tiny town near Jericho called Ai. And this one should have been just a nothing as far as the conquering of Canaan. It was just something in the process of conquering they needed to take care of. But God had told them that when they conquered Jericho that they were to take nothing from there because that was the first city. And everything there was to be dedicated to God. But there was a man named Achan who took some of the things, hid them in his tent. And because of that, God did not help the people out when it came to Ai, and they lost spectacularly. They had the odds in their favor by a long shot. And this little town defeated them. They eventually figured out it was Achan who had caused the sin. They punished Achan, stoned him to stone, burnt the bodies, then buried him under stone. And then in the chapter 8 was the actual conquest, where they go back again to conquer Ai. Joshua uses an interesting trick. He sends one group around to the backside, sends most of the army to the Ai, and then pretends basically that they were winning again, and falls back. Draws all the men out of the city, and they keep fighting, and while the men are out of the city, the soldiers he left behind came in, burnt the city to the ground, and the soldiers gave up when they saw that they had lost. Then we have in chapter 9 the trickery of the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites are at, Gibeon is actually a city south of the central region. Came in wanting to pretend like they were from a long distance because they wanted to make a treaty. They did not want to be conquered. They knew that the Israelites were winning too easily. And so they made their plans, tricked the Israelites into making a treaty with them. And even after they found out, the Israelites kept their word. In fact, it leads then to the next part, which is the southern campaign, which is actually takes place in chapter 10. Five of the kings, finding out the Gibeons had already turned on them, basically gathered together and attacked the Gibeons for their treaty. Joshua receives word. They march all night. They fight all day and rescue the Gibeonites. But what helped them was because these five kings brought their armies out, they basically were able to destroy all the cities in the south rapidly. They wiped out their armies and then was able to clean up afterwards. That then brings to the northern campaign in chapter 11. Again, the king of Hazor, which was the largest city up there, formed an alliance, decided they were going to get rid of the Israelites. And despite the large army, they were defeated. And again, the same type of thing. The armies were destroyed. Then all Joshua had to do was send the Israelites through, clean up, and they had the northern edge, sides of Canaan. What's interesting is that I've had numerous people, and I've read it a number of times, the campaigns that Joshua planned and did, they're written in the book of Joshua, are so technically detailed that generals oftentimes use this as basically a class book on how to conduct warfare. There are a lot of discussions and a lot of interesting ideas that are used and have been used in other battles as well. Chapter 12 is just basically a review of all the kings that were conquered on both sides of the river, and a listing of what they had done. Then almost the rest of the book from chapter 13 to chapter 21 deals with the division of the land. The land had been conquered. The major cities have been destroyed, but now the tribes get their territory and are told they need to clean up their own territories. There's still lots of Canaanites around. There's still lots of little towns that need to be conquered, but it was left up to each tribe to handle. Chapter 22 is very interesting because there was almost a civil war. Chapter 22. The tribes that had taken territory on the east side of the Jordan had crossed back over. And as they crossed back over, they built a memorial that looked like an altar. In fact, take a look at chapter 22, verse 10 and 11. It says, when they came to the region of the Jordan, which was in the land of Canaan, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. And the sons of Israel heard of it. Behold, the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. It's a good illustration of what we were talking about in the adult class this morning. They didn't get all their facts. They looked at it and said, they built an altar. They're going into idolatry already. And they raised an army and they were going to attack. Until somebody got the bright idea to at least ask what was going on. And in verse 24 was an explanation. But truly we've done this out of concern for a reason, saying in time to come your sons may say to our sons, what do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For God has made the Jordan a border between us and you, you sons of Reuben and sons of Gad, and you have no portion in the Lord. So your sons may make our sons stop fearing the Lord. Therefore we said, let us build an altar, not for burnt offering or for sacrifice, but rather it shall be a witness between us and you, between our generations after us, that we are to perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices, with our peace offerings, that your sons may not say to our sons in the time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. They were looking and saying, the Jordan's just too nice of a border. You're going to forget about us on the other side. We're going to put up a memorial so that everybody remembers that we all serve the same God. And that was what it was about. And the Civil War was averted. The last two chapters in Joshua is Joshua's farewell address. Here, Joshua tells the Israelites, God had fulfilled all his promises. It's a very important verse in 23, verse 14. Now behold, today I am going the way of all the earth, and you know in your hearts and in your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord spoke concerning you has failed. All has been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. That is an extremely important verse because we have a lot of people running around saying God never finished fulfilling his promises concerning Israel. Joshua says quite the opposite. God did everything he said he was going to do. There became a numerous nation. They became a nation. They had the land which God had promised them. But then Joshua also tells them what their future is going to be like. And it's very interesting. I want you to notice as I read this, he doesn't say if this happens. He says when this happens. Start with verse 15. And it shall come about that just as all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the threats until he has destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. When you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly off this good land which he has given you. Here's another promise. When this happens, you're gone. We have people that tried to restore Israel in the World War II because they figured that was push Christ's second coming sooner. They looked at it and said, well, you know, Israel has to be in place for Christ to come. No, Joshua told us. Joshua told them, when you go serving other idols, you're gone. It's not an if. Joshua said, this is going to happen. In contrast to that, in chapter 24, Joshua makes a personal statement. He says in verse 14, Joshua 24, verse 14, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river in Egypt and serve the Lord. And if it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourself today whom you will serve, whether it's the gods which your fathers have served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Steadfast choice. And that choice remains with us today. We can serve the Lord or we can serve the world's lusts. And we'll bear the consequence of those choices. But I want you to notice something else with Joshua's statement. Joshua's not talking about a daily choice. Well, I'm getting up this morning, it's Sunday, I wonder if I should go to church today or not. That choice was made once. And it was a steadfast choice that was going to last the rest of his family's life. It was made, and they remained faithful to that choice. That's the way we have to approach Christianity, too. You make a choice, and then you live by it for the rest of your life. There's an opportunity this morning, if there's anyone here who's not a child of God, there's an opportunity to make that choice, to serve God, to enter into a covenant with Christ. If there's anyone here who wishes to become a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. And if there's anyone here who is a child of God, would like the prayers of the brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song, Selected.